From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, mental health advocates and health plans are scoring off over who should control billions for mental health care in Michigan. What about campaign contributions?
And so when we saw this rift happening and the battle line sort of being drawn here, I thought it would be a good time to look at, you know, the tools being used by these two groups to persuade legislatures into making decisions.
The cultural issues behind female genital mutilation.
I spoke to every female relative I had, and without fail, every single one had been cut.
Teacher resignation letters posted online and going viral.
They were so used to their voices not being heard that they were shocked when they actually were heard.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just like the rest of the country, Michigan is losing malls and retail outlets. What can be done with the old buildings? Real estate experts say mixed use.
Office is coming in, residential is coming in, medical is coming in. A lot of different uses that you didn't used to see in the traditional mall.
But first, $2.5 billion in mental health care for 250,000 vulnerable Michiganders. That's what's at stake as Lansing figures out just who will control the state's behavioral health system. Advocates say patients and their families overwhelmingly want it to stay in the hands of the public. The health plans say they can run things more efficiently and effectively. Here's Dominic Pallone, the executive director of the Michigan Association of Health Plans. It's the plan's advocacy group. He was speaking on Stateside about the benefits of the more market-based approach to care.
Those that produce the highest quality would have the members enrolled into it, and ultimately the individual itself themselves would have the choice whether or not they wanted to be enrolled in a managed care plan or whether they wanted to maintain under a fee-for-service-based system, and they'd be able to choose between multiple managed care plans throughout various regions of the state.
The health plans have been pressing lawmakers for more control of the billions of Medicaid dollars that go to mental health services annually in Michigan. So far, key legislators have responded favorably. A joint examination by Stateside and the Michigan Campaign Finance Network looked into just how campaign contributions might be playing a role. Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network is here with us, and so is Stateside's executive producer, Joe Lindstroth. What made you decide to look at campaign contributions now?
The governor last budget cycle proposed this shift to the health plans, and the advocates and the community mental health organizations kind of got pretty angry. And so the legislature said, kind of put the brakes on it, ask for a committee to be formed, a work group to be formed with all of these parties involved to come up with a plan. Now, they've been meeting for the last 14 months, to come up with ways of pilot projects to how to integrate behavioral and mental health care. They came out with a report earlier this year with more than 70 recommendations to the legislature. It did not include handing things over to the health plans like the governor requested. And so the health plans kind of said their voices weren't represented in this group. And so they kind of took wrote a minority report and then started going directly to legislators themselves to argue for their cause. And so when we saw this rift happening and the battle line sort of being drawn here, I thought it would be a good time to look at, you know, the tools being used by these two groups to persuade legislatures into making decisions.
All right, it's time to talk about where the money comes in, and for that we go to Craig Mauger. Craig, you looked at the contributions coming into legislators, campaign funds, and PACs. So first off, who are the main senators in this debate, names that we need to know?
Yeah, definitely the main senators in this debate are one, Jim Marlowe. He's the chair of the subcommittee that creates the first draft budget proposal for the department under which these programs fall. Senator Mike Shirkey is another important name, because he is a big player on health care issues in the Senate. And then just Senate leadership and House leadership. Jim Ananick is the Dem leader in the Senate. The Republican leader in the Senate is Arlen Meekoff.
What'd you find when you looked at the money they received?
Yeah, definitely. So we looked at the giving over a period of 8 years, and we chose 8 years to kind of show the relationship over a long period of time between groups and state lawmakers. And we found that Jim Marlowe had received the second most money from health plan donors of all state individual state legislators, and Mike Shirkey had received the most money of all individual state lawmakers from health plan donors, and these are two of the most crucial lawmakers working on these healthcare subjects.
And Senator Shirky, what kind of money are we talking about?
Yeah, these are donations, some small, some rather large, to his candidate committee, to his leadership pack, the pack that he operates, and to another. We also looked at this administrative account that he's connected to. These donations can range from a couple $100s to one single donation of $25,000 that Senator Shirky got just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, talk about the timing of the donations.
In subcommittee on April 18th, Senator Shirky sponsored the crucial amendment that kind of stated in the budget that the state is going to move forward toward a fully integrated system under the health plans by 2020. That was on April 18th. The next day, on April 19th, his leadership pack reported in the campaign finance disclosure receiving a $25,000 individual contribution from insurance executive John Cotton, who is tied in an executive with Meridian Health Plan. Senator Shirky says that the timing of that was coincidental, that he's seeking to be in Senate leadership next session, and John Cotton wanted to support him in that, and that's the reason the check happened, and the check happened right before the end of the fundraising period, which I believe was April 20th. So he was kind of explaining that as the timing and really dismissing the idea that that was any way or any of these contributions are somehow directly tied to what he is doing on this integration matter.
And Cindy, I asked Kevin Fisher about this, the executive director of the National Alliance of Mental Illness Michigan, about Senator Shirky's amendment. Here's what he said.
He has provided absolutely no rationale as to why he would want to turn his back on the citizens of Michigan and hand the health plan $2.5 billion. And unless there's some other rationale that he can bring forth, I would be willing to assume that campaign contribution plays a role.
Moving over to the House, the Appropriations Committee held a hearing last week, and its chair, Republican Laura Cox, introduced an amendment that would give the health plans control of a pilot project integrating behavioral and physical health care, and it passed on a straight party line vote. Craig, did Representative Cox receive any contributions from the health plans?
Yes, she did. She was the sixth highest individual recipient of health plan donations that we tracked. She was the number one highest of all House members. You got to keep in mind, we were looking over a period of 8 years, so that's going to lend an advantage in our tracking numbers to senators who've been in Lansing longer. I mean, Representative Cox has been here. This is her second term in Lansing, so she's had less time to raise money, and she's already taken in $34,650 from health plan donors.
Now, the health plans weren't the only ones giving money. What about contributions from the mental health boards? What'd you find there, Craig?
Yeah, the mental health boards have definitely given donations as well. The community mental health boards have a PAC that has been writing contributions regularly over the past 8 years as well. The mental health boards PAC has given $40,600 directly to state lawmakers over the last 8 years, which is a rather large figure, but nothing compared to what the health plans have done.
Joe, what are the advocates and people from the community mental health agency saying about all of this?
Well, you know, we've been covering this, Cindy, as you know, on stateside for the last 14 months. And Kevin Fisher from NAMI, Michigan, has been on our show a number of times, and he always kind of said he was cautiously optimistic about this process. These work groups were moving forward. They were, you know, everyone was kind of staying on board. They almost actually walked away last September. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly came in and kind of brought them back to the table. But again, he repeated this phrase, cautiously optimistic. And so when they finally kind of came with this report, after all of this work over 13 months or so, to then kind of have the health plan say, you know what, forget it, we're going to have our own plan, we didn't feel represented here, there's disappointment, there's frustration from a number of the advocates that I spoke to. On the community mental health side, I think there is some disappointment there as well. I spoke with Tom Watkins, who's president and CEO of Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, and here's how he put it.
This shouldn't be about who's making the best and the biggest political contributions. At the end of the day, it's not those people that we're talking about. This is somebody's mother, someone's father, someone's brother, someone's sister, someone's whose life literally is going to depend on the care that the legislature is going to make. That is not something that should be up to the highest political bid. I think that would be a travesty.
I think it is worth noting. It is next to impossible to draw a straight line between campaign contributions and lawmakers' decisions on this issue or any issue. So, Craig, what if these lawmakers just feel that the health plans are the best way to go?
Many of them do feel that way. I mean, they have made arguments. Senator Shirky has argued. I talked to him this week. He made the argument that he thinks that there could be savings achieved by having the health plans do this, and he thinks the health plans have done a great job for the state in what they're doing currently, and he kind of basically says, why not push that success over to this behavioral health side of things as well? I think the contributions do point to, however, relationships that these groups have built with lawmakers over time. And really, this issue is a case study in how Lansing works. These state lawmakers are making decisions that directly impact businesses' bottom lines and that directly reach into people's lives in the state. And at the same time, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars in lobbying happening and hundreds of thousand dollars in campaign contributions changing hands. And all of this intermingles and mixes around, and eventually the lawmakers are going to arrive at a decision, and only they really know what is driving them to make that decision.
I think it also calls into question kind of the whole point of the work group and why it was set up to begin with. If most of these legislators felt this way already, why have the payers and providers, the advocates, and the health plans meet 45 to 50 times? Why bring in over 1,000, 1,200 people from the public and get their take on these things if this was the way they were going to go anyway?
Well, you can find the detailed story of all of this at the stateside page at michiganradio.org, or you can go to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network site, mcfn.org. Craig Mauger, Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Joe Lindstroth, stateside, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Google teacher resignation letters. You will get over 2.1 million results. More and more teachers are posting their resignation letters online, and those in turn get shared around social media. Alyssa Hadley-Dunn realized these teacher resignation letters should be studied. She's an assistant professor of teacher education at Michigan State University. She assembled a team of colleagues and grad students to examine the resignation letters and talk to some of the former teachers. The result? Three separate studies that find these resignation letters offer a worrisome look at the state of public education in this country. Alyssa Hadley-Dunn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
How did you hit on the idea of studying these letters?
Actually, I learned about it from my former students who were practicing teachers, and they started sharing these letters on Facebook or sending me emails saying that they had read the letters online and that that was how they were feeling. And what did I think about that as a teacher educator? So it was actually thanks to my own students saying that they felt like the profession was demoralizing them and burning them out that I even knew that these letters existed in the first place.
So what's in most of these letters? Are there common themes?
There are, yes. So even though the teachers did not look at each other's letters as models before they wrote their own, you know, they're written over a time span of 4 to 5 years, we found lots of common themes across the letters. So, for example, there were teachers saying that they were demoralized by neoliberal practices that made them feel like they had no voice in policy creation or policy implementation. So things like standardized testing and teacher evaluation, these are things that affect teachers' working conditions and students' learning conditions every day. But teachers really had no voice in saying whether or not these policies would be useful or harmful in their classrooms.
Now, you say neoliberal policies, and that just confused me a bit because so much of the kind of push we're seeing for testing and holding teachers accountable seem to come from the conservative side of the legislature and conservative education people.
Right. So neoliberal ideology is not confined to Democrats or Republicans. Mm. It's like an overarching political philosophy that values capitalism and competition, or that values, as a scholar named Noam Chomsky says, values profit over people. neoliberalism actually creates these strange bedfellows of liberals and conservatives around issues of competition in education. Competition is linked to things like charter schools, voucher programs, and standardized testing. So that's why we see that some of the same policies that are advocated for, or that were advocated for in Obama's administration, were actually just extensions of what Bush had created under No Child Left Behind.
As you examined letters and talked to teachers, are we talking about public school teachers, not private or not charter?
We are talking about predominantly public school teachers and charter schools. Many of them are public, so those teachers would be included as well.
All right. So when you talked to teachers who had posted mm-hmm. their letters, what did you learn in your discussions with them?
Well, first we learned that they didn't expect them to go viral.
So, why is that?
They really just posted them for personal reasons. Like, they wanted their colleagues and their families to know what it was like to be a teacher in today's world and what was pushing them out. So they thought, well, maybe, you know, I'll share this open letter that I've written to my principal about why I'm leaving. And maybe people in my small sphere of influence or my small inner circle will hear about it, we'll do something about it, we'll think differently about what's happening in education today. But they never expected that it would become such a phenomenon, that it would go viral, that it would be picked up by Diane Ravitch or the Washington Post, or that they'd be asked to come on the Today Show. So really, they were so used to their voices not being heard that they were shocked when they actually were heard.
Do the former teachers feel the biggest problems are at the federal level or the state levels?
I think it depends on which teacher was writing the letter, whether it was federal, state, district, or local contexts that were particularly challenging for them. So depending on which state they were in, they may have had particular challenging feelings or conditions related to a policy like Race to the Top, for example. So Race to the Top tied teacher evaluations to students' test scores on high-stakes tests. So we see teachers in states that got Race to the Top funding, like Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina. We see those teachers really pushing back against how the state is choosing to use federal monies to supposedly improve education.
How are these letters affecting your students? Here you've got these young people in front of you hoping to be teachers. I've got to wonder what they're thinking as they read these letters.
Yeah, that's something that my colleagues and I are very concerned about. I think a lot about what does it mean for me, even as a teacher leaver, to prepare the next generation of teachers for a profession that I have left and that I know potentially might burn them out. So what I really emphasize when I'm talking to them about this is how to use the letters to see what they need going into the profession. So how can they collaborate with each other? How can they collectively organize and find groups of other teachers and community activists who will support them in the profession? So they see these letters not as something that should necessarily make them fearful, but as something that will give them as much information as possible about the context that they're entering so that they're not surprised when they get there. They know what they're up against, and then we give them strategies for how to fight back.
Now I'm going to back up the truck.
Okay.
You just dropped a phrase there. You have left the profession.
Yes.
Tell me
right.
a little about that. So you're not speaking just from academia. You've been through this.
Right. Yes. Most teacher educators or professors of education were teachers themselves. So I was a high school English teacher in an urban school, and I experienced many of the same challenges that the teachers are writing about in their letters. My co-authors, doctoral students, and another assistant professor here at MSU also were teachers who have left.
So what are the lessons that these resignation letters from teachers hold for policymakers and for school administrators?
I think that the letters make it very clear that teachers want to be heard and that they have opinions that are of value. So teachers are on the ground working with students and learning about the best ways to teach them and to support them in their academic and their social emotional development every day. But they're not often asked about their opinions when it comes to creating or implementing policies at whatever level. So if policymakers or administrators were reading this, they could see this as a call for including teachers in the policymaking process.
How likely do you think that is to happen?
I hope that it's likely. I have to hope, or else, you know, what are we doing every day?
Alyssa Hadley Dunn, Michigan State University Assistant Professor of Teacher Education. Her trio of studies explores just what teachers' viral resignation letters can tell us all about the state of public teaching. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Alyssa.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show or want to give something a re-listen, you can find it all on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast, and you'll get the link.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
More and more of us are choosing to shop in the comfort of our homes and not by heading to the mall. A few clicks of a mouse and your purchases can be delivered to your door in a day or two. Because the retail industry built too much space during the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, dead or dying malls are dotting our suburbs. And now the question is, what do we do with them? Cindy Sierra is a principal at CC Consulting of Bloomfield Hills. It's a commercial real estate and retail consulting firm, and it's a pleasure to say, Cindy, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
This historic change in our shopping habits, it certainly is on display here in Michigan. I mean, I grew up shopping at Northland Mall in Southfield, and it is still hard for me to wrap my mind around the fact it is no more. Did anyone predict that e-commerce would hollow out these suburban shopping malls and really spell the end of some pretty venerable big retailing names?
Well, I think, you know, there are a number of things that enter into, you know, what is happening in the retail area. I think that, you know, cyber shopping is just one part of it. I think our crunch for time, I think coupled with, you know, rents that are continuing to go up as the economy strengthens, I think just the traditional brick and mortar stores, they need to learn how they coexist with cyber shopping. Many people, if you're going to go shopping for clothes, you got to touch it and feel it. So yes, you can do your internet shopping, but traditional shopping is never going to go away. So I think there's a number of different items that are happening that are really needed to understand to what exactly is going on in the retail industry.
But we sure don't have to look far to find communities that are pretty challenged to find a new use for that mall that withered once big anchor stores closed. Around the country, Cindy, can you give us some ideas of what malls are being transformed into?
The big buzz in our industry right now is mixed use. Mixed use is, it's what it's all about. I'm going to be going to a conference in 3 weeks in Las Vegas. It's one of the largest conventions in the world. It's in Las Vegas. It's called Recon. And everybody is talking about mixed use. And what's happening, there's one of two things. Either malls are being repurposed to include this mixed use component, which means office is coming in, residential is coming in, medical is coming in, a lot of different uses that you didn't used to see in the traditional mall. And so that's what is happening. And mixed use is the buzzword. And a perfect example, you just mentioned Northland.
Mm-hmm.
Northland is going to be repurposed into a mixed use development.
So what might that look like?
Well, it's going to have a residential component. Residential components are, as we find out more and more about the millennial market, we're finding out that that particular age group doesn't like to buy homes. How unusual is that?
Hmm.
My age group, you know, families couldn't wait to buy a first home. Well, that's different. Millennials are holding off, and they like to rent. They don't like to purchase. And so you're finding condos, you're finding apartments, you're finding a lot of not traditional homes that are being built specifically with millennials in mind.
And they're being built in the existing building. So would that old Hudson's where I bought my wedding dress, would that be converted into lofts?
Well, I think that particular building would be difficult. But in other markets, old department stores have been converted. I think, you know, Northland was a little bit of a untraditional type department store because it has ramps underneath it and a shipping and, you know, it has a whole tunnel system underneath it. Now, that said, it could be a very nice home for some sort of a distribution type company for an office user. I don't think residential is quite the right use for that, but I do think there are other uses that could use that old building.
So being able to put these mixed-use developments in with the existing buildings, so not by leveling everything and starting from the ground up.
That's correct. That's correct. But, you know, and then just going on that, what you just said about leveling, I'm involved in the Silver Dome project. You know, we all know that was the home of the Detroit Lions for many, many years. And, you know, different folks have looked at that, tried to repurpose that. It wasn't what the users particularly wanted, and that project is going to be torn down over the next couple of months. And quite honestly, a mixed-use development is what's going to go in that particular project as well.
But what are the economic advantages, Cindy, of reusing the mall space? Like, let's harken back to Fairlane or what might you because isn't Ford moving some of its workers into the old Lord and Taylor building?
They are, a couple thousand workers, and they're going there, and they're excited about going there. You know, now they're going to be able to work in a facility where they've got, you know, places, restaurants for lunchtime. They can go shopping. It's a very desirable space, and in office use is just another, you know, go back to that mixed-use development. Yeah. It's just another way that some of these old department stores are being repurposed.
I have to wonder, will they have to do without windows?
Well, many, you know, many do and money can be added. So I think, you know, it's being done both ways across the country. But, you know, in some facilities, you know, with all the amenities and things like that that could be added, Ford Motor is a good example of that. I don't know if windows are particularly, you know, that's maybe not a selling feature. Hmm. But I think that many of these buildings are, you know, being put into beautiful office complexes that are, you know, like I said, I'm in a big office complex. If I was in a mall, I think it would be pretty exciting.
What needs to be in place, Cindy, for communities that are, you know, looking at this, at zombie malls or a dead mall, and they want to transform vacant mall properties into these mixed-use developments?
Well, there's a couple of things that have to happen. I think most importantly, the ownership has to recognize that a change needs to be made. And quite honestly, Cindy, in many cases, that's always a hindrance. Many times companies want to hang on to what was. And, you know, that's unfortunately when that happens in many cases, the mall continues to decline and things aren't happening. But the idea of repurposing, and in the Detroit area, there's a couple of really great examples of that. Look at the old Tel 12 mall. I mean, that's been repurposed. It's a very successful Meijer store now. It's got a bunch of junior anchors, you know, his outlots with different restaurants in it. It's a very successful redo of, you know, what was a traditional mall and done very successfully.
So think outside the box. But as we were saying at the kind of beginning of all of this, there was an oversaturation of malls. So now
there was.
How do we make sure that we don't overdevelop for mixed use?
Well, you know, that is always the challenge. The one category that has been talked about in very recent years, is the senior housing category. You know, as the baby boomers are aging, these senior facilities, I mean, they're being built everywhere. You see such a tremendous saturation. Okay, you know, 30, 40 years from now, are we going to need all these senior housing facilities? And so, you know, that is a, you know, it's a relevant question and it's a concern. And I think that, you know, you're going to see a transition. You're going to see different types of retail, different types of development being popular. And it just so happens that mixed use is the popular format right now.
Cindy Sierra is the principal at CC Consulting of Bloomfield Hills. It was great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it and look forward to sharing some ideas with you again.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. Well, the 2017 NFL Draft is in the rearview mirror, so let's start with the Lions. What overall grade would you give Bob Quinn?
I give him probably a BB plus, which is higher than the national grades he's getting, between Bs and Cs. I would say one reason why is Jared Davis, the linebacker out of Florida, first-round pick. That guy is going to start right away, and that is what they need. So it's not just the star power of the people you get, but what do you need now? They've got a quarterback. They don't need one. And quarterbacks get attention, so you're not going to get one of those.
Were there any holes? Is there anything where you wished that he had drafted a position? I do have to say, I noticed you were tweeting your displeasure at their pick for tight end.
Oh, we're getting to that.
Okay.
I said BB plus. I didn't say A. they picked in the fourth round Michael Roberts, a very good tight end out of Toledo, blowing off Jake Butt from Michigan, of course. Jake Butt was going to be a first-round draft pick this year, suffered a torn ACL in Michigan's bowl game, and dropped from a first-rounder to a fifth-rounder. Even with his insurance policy, which pays off around $500,000, he lost about $3 million in that one. So you're going to see more players blow off bowl games next year based on this experience. And how can you argue? If it's going to cost you $4 million, it's hard to argue.
If you're a senior and you've got the draft right around the corner.
Sad to say, we know your coach would. Not necessarily Jim Harbaugh, but P.J. Fleck, of course, at Western. These other guys have all bolted all points of the season. So that's kind of a sad story to me. I think Jake Butt will get the last laugh. And as far as all this stuff goes, don't forget my favorite line from Goldman and Hollywood, of course. Nobody knows anything. Here is my favorite scouting report. Okay. Poor build. Skinny. Lacks mobility and ability to avoid the rush. Lacks a really strong arm. Tom Brady.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Sixth
round, 199th. So pour salt on all of it.
What about, as you look around at Michigan schools, what are some of the highlights that you see, you know, as well? Certainly with Michigan, that was quite the draft class this year. Set a record for the program.
Set a record for the program. Most NFL draft picks this year for any program, which is rare for Michigan, of course, 11 this year. Yeah. And Alabama had 10, so one for Harbaugh. You have to give Brady Hoke, the previous coach, some credit as well. He recruited them, of course, but Harbaugh developed them. If Hoke was still the head coach, you do not get 11 NFL draft picks. Sorry.
What about MSU? How'd they do?
MSU had a record poor year, two draft picks. They're in a league, therefore, they're behind Louisiana Tech. They're behind Western Michigan, for that matter. So just a bad year on and off the field. Malik McDowell, their biggest player, supposed to be a top five pick, dropped to the second round. Mm. And I bet if you ask the coaches at Michigan State in the dead of night, are they upset to see him go? They would not be. He was not a team guy. The team had all kinds of problems. If D'Antonio goes back to what he did to build that program, they'll be successful again. Mm. But chasing after stars is not his recipe.
Speaking of Western, Corey Davis.
How about
Western?
Three draft picks higher than a good chunk of the Big Ten. Yeah. And Corey Davis, their first NFL first rounder ever. Corey Davis is a great story. This guy could have been, you know, third, fourth, fifth round last year. Came back, got his degree. It's very important to his parents. His parents have got no money, often did not even have a car. He came back, and because he's a first rounder, he's going to get a contract around $25 million, somewhere in there. So it paid off. Got your degree. Well done, young man.
That's terrific. Eastern, I know defensive end Pat O'Connor from Eastern got picked by the Lions.
God bless him.
There you go. And then our favorite name, quarterback Cooper Rush of Central. Now, he was undrafted but then signed with Dallas.
Which actually is not a bad thing. Believe it or not, being a seventh-round pick like Pat O'Connor is actually worse than being a free agent in many cases. Because seventh round does not guarantee you anything except that only one team can take you, and that's the Lions in his case. Now, in Cooper Rush's case, free agent, anybody who wants him can pick him up, and somebody's going to need a quarterback at some point during this year. So he'll be a backup somewhere is my guess.
A lot of emotions, people waiting for phone calls. Is there any way to know how many of these young players that we saw drafted will become players that we get to know week in and week out?
There are stats on this, but I would say out of this whole draft, 15, 20 maybe. I mean, it's not much because guess what? They've got a draft every year, and you only get 53 players or so in the NFL. So how many guys are going to be impact players? Very few. Look, the average lifespan on an NFL player is about 2.3 years. That's if you make it. So, young men, I got news for you. Get the degree and plan for after this. They say not for long is NFL.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Cindy.
We're going to talk now about female genital mutilation. And a warning, some of this conversation could be disturbing to some listeners. As you probably have heard, federal officials have filed charges against a suburban Detroit physician. It is unlawful to perform female genital mutilation in this country. Dr. Jumana Nagarwala is charged with performing female genital mutilation on 2 7-year-old Minnesota girls. She has pleaded not guilty. Her attorney says she was performing a religious ritual of the Bora community, not genital mutilation. Two others are charged with conspiring to perform the act. The World Health Organization describes most of the female genital mutilations, sometimes called FGM, as the partial or total removal of the clitoris and labia minora. Some of these cuttings go further. There is no health benefit. The practice is most common in the western, eastern, and northeastern regions of Africa, in some countries of the Middle East and Asia, as well as among migrants from these areas. Zara Patwa is an activist from New Haven, Connecticut. She's with a group called Speak Out on FGM. And she spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
You are part of a community which performs this procedure. Can you tell me who the Bora are?
The Boras are a community of people, mostly in India, but there is a diaspora across the Western world as well, in Europe, in the US, Australia, etc. So we're known as a very well-educated community, strong business people, strong in women's rights, that, you know, the women tend to be educated as well and are very much part of the management of the community. There is a very strong connection to the community because, especially with people that have then spread out to various other countries, that desire to hold on to our culture and hold on to those wonderful traditions of our community is very strong. But we are a very small group. We're about, you know, 1.5 million people across the whole world.
Is it correct to call Bora a sect of Islam?
Yes, we are a sect of Shia Islam.
So tell me about how common female genital mutilation is in that community.
Well, I'm 46, and when I found out about FGM, it's called Kutna, or cuffs in our community. When I found out about female Kutna, I spoke to every female relative I had, and without fail, every single one had been cut. So that was a stark kind of thing to find out. And a survey was done by Seyul, another group that is working on FGMC in Asian countries, specifically in India with the Bora community. They did a survey last year that showed that about 80% of women had been cut. Now, I don't know whether right now that percentage is as high, but the practice is still fairly widely practiced.
I want to clarify one thing. This is not a widely practiced procedure in Islam. This is limited primarily to this one Shia sect. Is that correct?
No, there are actually communities in Indonesia and various other places that do practice FGM. But it's not simply an Islamic thing. The majority of Islamic communities condemn the practice and have come out very strongly, especially with the case in Detroit, that this is not a practice that they condone at all. And FGM is not a religious practice. It has been attributed to various religions, but it's actually a cultural practice. We've seen it happening in all religions all over the world, and it really isn't tied to one religion. So to say that it's an Islamic practice is really not accurate at all. In fact, it was happening in the US in the 1950s within Christian communities as well to stop girls from masturbating.
To better understand this, what is the purpose of cutting off parts of female genitalia?
My personal opinion is none, nothing.
What is the stated purpose?
Right. Well, we've heard from various people that it is for cleanliness, but there is no medical evidence for that. There is that it reduces your sexual desire, that it increases your sexual drive, and that it keeps girls from going astray. And the clergy have said that there is this religious component to it. Some schools of Islamic thought consider that to be a religious obligation, not very many. Some consider it to be a preference, and some say it should be the choice of the woman.
I understand there's a lot of pressure from the family because it's considered shameful that you're not a good girl if you've not undergone this cutting of the genitalia. Why?
Because of the prevailing notion that Kutna will keep your girls from straying, from having premarital sex or having sexual relations outside of marriage, there is this perception that it will keep the honor of the family. So it's unfortunate because that really isn't what it does. What it does is it shames girls, it hurts girls, it causes psychological issues all through their lives, and it doesn't reduce sexual desire, it reduces the ability to enjoy their sexuality for some women.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the mental health aspects, the health aspects, and the sexual consequences of female genital mutilation. You said some people walk away with no trauma, others are traumatized for life.
Yeah. We've had a lot of conversations with women who say that their sex lives within their marriages are really tough. They have problems with, you know, freezing up during intimacy, being scared during intimacy, or, you know, wanting to have intimacy but not being able to reach climax. And that's frustrating.
So this idea of using this procedure to suppress sexual urges by women so they won't have sex outside of marriage, presumably, to my mind, this is kind of the worst kind of male oppression. What do Bora women, many of whom, as you mentioned, are well-educated and living in the United States, what do they think of this practice?
Well, in private conversations, many, many women have spoken to the members of our group and within their own families and within their own friends' groups that they really don't like this practice. They didn't particularly like having it, even if it didn't cause them a huge amount of trauma for the rest of their lives. But for many women, it did. But there really is this veil over the whole practice that it's not to be spoken of. So much so that I found out about Cut9 in our community 4 years ago, and at the same time learned that I was cut at 7 years old in India. Now, if I had not found out, I'd found out by watching a video of somebody else talking about it, I would never have known that this was going on in my community. There really, literally is no discussion about it. Now, I don't have any sisters and I don't have any daughters, so I guess I didn't have the opportunity to bring that subject up. But we've spoken to many women who have sisters and who never talked about it either, because when they were taken for the cut, they were told never to talk about it again. And even when parents do approach the elders of the community when they're ready to have their daughters cut, it is this very kind of underground network. You don't really know who does it, but you know who to talk to who will get it done for you.
The charges against Dr. Nagarwala look to be the first case like this in the U.S. What do you know about how common this is in the U.S.?
Unfortunately, we don't have a good idea of how common it is in the U.S. because it is so secretive. We've had a lot of trouble getting people to speak out about it because there is this kind of veil of secrecy around it that, you know, it's to do with sexuality and it's to do with women's private parts. So therefore, we must not talk about it in public. And that it also exposes the community to something that maybe is not very savory. So it kind of brings shame onto the community so that we shouldn't discuss it. But I feel very strongly that we can maybe not talk about it outside of the community, but we need to have a dialogue within our community.
You're speaking out about female genital mutilation among the Bora. You've been accused of bringing down the Bora community. Who's saying that to you?
People who are, I guess, embarrassed about the exposure to this practice. And I'm a proud member of the Bora community. I go to the mosque. I have friends there. I belong to a very moderate mosque, and it's wonderful. It doesn't compute for me that we are such a forward-thinking community, especially with some of the mosques in the U.S., and we do such great things. We do a lot of community service, and, you know, it's wonderful. And yet we do this backward practice that doesn't seem to make any sense. And having talked to so many people, there really isn't that much support for the practice, but people don't want to outwardly say that because they're afraid of consequences. And many of us have tried very hard to have conversations with the clergy, and we've sent many letters and requested meetings, and there is just no answer.
The clerics, the mosques, basically don't talk about this, but have they said anything about stopping it in the U.S.?
No. Even with the moderate mosque I belong to, I have not been able to get a meeting with the Amil, the leader of the mosque. I've tried. Now, after the Sydney, Australia case, where three people were convicted of FGM in December of 2015, over the next few months in the US, in the UK, Australia, individual mosques sent out letters to their members saying that Khatna may be considered illegal under, you know, whatever federal or state laws, and we encourage you not to do it, you should not do it, and we will not support you if you do it.
Why does the practice continue if the mosques have put out these letters?
So the feeling is that these letters were just put out to cover any potential liability if there was a situation where it was found out that Khatna was happening. Just for this kind of situation, like what happened in Detroit. And the Detroit mosque did put out a statement saying, we sent out a letter last year that said, do not do it. However, many people believe that the message coming from the central leadership in India is more nuanced than that. That, yes, you must respect the laws of the land you live in. However, Khatna must be done. It is a religious obligation. However, what's written in the religious books is that Khatna must not be done before the age of 7. So there is no upper limit as to when it should be done. So what we at Speak Out on FGM are arguing for is, well, then let it be a practice that can be done as an adult through the choice of the woman, as opposed to doing it to a 7-year-old girl.
Isn't that opening up a risk to adult women who are married, who are being pressured by their spouse to do that?
Right. But within that same message, it should be that this is not something that must be done. And I was told this by my local mosque, that it is not a practice that is mandatory, that it is a practice that is preferable at the choice of the woman herself. So if that message is given, then the people who want to do it can do it as an adult. We are not here to tell women what they can do with their bodies. That would not be right. I mean, it's their bodies, it's their choice. However, when it's a child, it is somebody else's body that you're making a decision about.
Zara Patwa is a member of the Bora community, and she's an activist with the group Speak Out on FGM. Thanks for helping us better understand this.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.